Okay, so I'm gonna basically illustrate some of the points that Matthew already made in terms of signaling and feedback and morphogens. And so the more general interest of the lab is, you know, how vertebrates develop. I used to work on flies, but in the last 10 years I've been studying vertebrate development using zebrafish as a model. And so the system I would like to focus on is, it actually goes back to Eric Wieshaus's introduction in the fruit fly, is gastrulation. And mainly in the fish, the way it looks like, you have this cap of cells sitting on top of the yolk. So it's like a ski cap sitting on your head. And these cells here at the margin are the cells that will form mesoderm and endoderm. So they will move inside and form, you know, pancreas and heart and gut and all these internal organs. And so if you would label a cell here, it would go inside and form mesoderm and endoderm. So in terms of, so this is very similar to what Eric told you about, you know, the ventral fora in the fly where cells move inside. And so it's basically these cells here that will have to form or have to be told to become mesoderm and endoderm, and these cells up here will form ectoderm. Just to again illustrate this point, so if you label those cells, you know, they would move inside here and go inside. So the talk will basically only focus on how do you determine this territory. So how come that only these cells here form mesoderm and endoderm and not these cells up here? So that's going to be the first part. With, you know, how do you determine the extent of this tissue, of these progenitors? And then the other part will be how do you pattern it? So we'll talk about basically, you know, you imagine a field of cells. So we want to know, why are these cells becoming mesoderm and endoderm and not all these cells, for example? Okay, so what you have to know for that is the another signaling pathway. Now, of the TGF-beta family, DPP is also a TGF-beta signaling pathway, but this one is called the nodal signaling pathway. And so the players we have are the nodals, so these are the TGF-betas, and in the fish there are two, cyclops and squint. They activate these receptors, activin receptors. This leads to the phosphorylation of SMAD2, a transcription factor. This goes to the nucleus, associates with other factors, and then regulates various downstream genes. So this is kind of a pretty linear activation of downstream genes via the signal. So again, just like Matthew told you for other signaling pathway, or you also heard this from Norbert Perrimont, is that they are, of course, twists and modulators of the pathway. So on one hand, in vertebrates...
Where does endoderm and mesoderm, where are they on this?
Down here. These are the genes.
That's what I want to know. That actually specifies the mesoderm.
Those are, there will be, actually most of the genes that are activated are more transcription factors than signals. But that's basically like, this signal gives you the position where you will form mesoderm and endoderm. Yeah. But it's not like, you're not going to activate gut enzymes, for example, at this stage yet. Yeah.
But
no, those are the cofactors, the co-transcription factors that bind to SMAD2 then give promoter specificity.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So as I said, so there's this one twist where you have these co-receptors of the EGF-CFC family, and so, you know, as true as it is, as Matthew said, basically the signals kind of are the limiting component in most of these signaling pathways. But in this case, cells actually need this co-receptor to activate the pathway. And there are, some, for example, some cells that do not express this EGF-CFC protein, and they will not be able to respond to the signal. So you can also modulate the response to the signal by making available or not available downstream components of the pathway. And then the other twist is a negative feedback, which is this TGF-beta molecule called Lefty. And Lefty, again, similar to Argos, is induced by the pathway, is made, and then blocks the activation of the pathway. Unfortunately, it's not really known how this happens at the molecular level, although genetics suggests that it probably happens at the level of receptor binding. So we think at the moment that nodal and lefties, similar to Spitz and Argos, compete for binding to the serine/threonine kinase receptors. Okay, so this is the basic pathway that you have to know about. And so what I will talk about is kind of how the interplay of nodal and lefty determines the extent of this mesodermal tissue. So again, to put you in the TGF-beta superfamily, here are the nodals and here are the lefties. So they are both TGF-beta molecules, but these are antagonists, these are agonists of the pathway, DPP would be up here that you already heard about.
Is that the yep. only inhibitor in that list?
At the moment, is that right? No, there are inhibins. So these inhibins here, they also block activin signal. That's right. So there are different. There are several TGF-beta molecules that can act as inhibitors. That's
and are correct. They both in the same? Are we talking about different species here, or I mean, do you get inhibins and lefties in the same?
In the same organism, but not in the same cell.
Okay.
Yeah. I should also point out these are vertebrate specific. So nodules do not exist in Drosophila or C. elegans, for example, nor do the lefties. So although TGF-beta signaling is conserved, this particular sub-pathway is not conserved, has been developed more recently. Okay, so they're involved in mesoderm and endoderm induction. They're also involved in left-right axis determination. So one kind of stunning thing about these nodules is that they're only expressed on the left side. Later during development, they're only expressed on the left side in your body. And there are, you know, human patients, for example, that have defects actually in the coreceptor here in the EGF-CFC family, where you have left-right defects. Okay, so the EGF-CFC proteins are shown here. So these are the coreceptors. They sit at the membrane attached with a GPI linkage. So they sit right at the membrane. There's no cytoplasmic component to it. And then they have these two cysteine-rich domains that probably meet binding of the ligand to the receptor. Okay, so again, this is the pathway. And in the fish now, we have cyclops and squint, two nodal signals. Again, this is a kind of maybe a vertebrate-specific thing that you have a large expansion of all these signaling molecules. So I think 10 years ago, it wasn't so clear if, you know, vertebrates would do exactly the same as let's say, more primitive or more, you know, invertebrates, let's say, not primitive, it's a bad word, invertebrates. So I think that one result that comes out of, you know, genome analysis and also genetic studies is that basically in vertebrates you just seem to have more bells and whistles. So you seem to have similar pathways, TGF-beta, hedgehog, and wingless, but maybe in TGF-beta signaling in the fly, there's no clear evidence for these feedback inhibitors, for example. Or DPP signaling, instead of having just one inhibitor like short gastrulation, in vertebrates you have additional ones like follistatin or noggin. So it's just more complexity at every level in vertebrates. But I think some of the fundamental principles are probably the same. Okay, so why do these have these funny names? So these genes were initially identified in genetic screens. And, you know, they have these cyclopic phenotypes. So normally, you know, a fish has two eyes. And now if you look at the cyclops mutant, has only, you know, one eye, two lenses. And the one-eyed pinhead mutant here has only one eye. Okay, so where are these genes expressed? So both signals, both nodal signals, both cyclops and squint are expressed right down here, overlapping and next to the cells that will become mesoderm and endoderm. Okay, and actually lefties are also induced in those very same cells with a little bit of a delay because cyclops and squint activate lefty, but basically both the agonists and the antagonists are here early on. And then, as I will show, will induce these cells to become mesoderm and endoderm. Okay, so if you now look, if you make mutants for cyclops and squint, so you remove both ligands or you remove the coreceptors, instead of cells moving inside and forming mesoderm and endoderm, cells will stay outside, move down here, and actually are transformed into neural tissue. So these signals are really fate switches. So if you have the signal, you become mesoderm and endoderm. If you don't have the signal, you will become ectoderm. Okay. So we can see this defect of morphogenesis. We already see this before gastrulation. And so here, these are the cells. This is a marker called Bicari. This marker kind of precedes or shows us where the mesoderm and endoderm progenitors will be. So it's about 10 to 15 cells or so at the margin. And if you now take away cyclops and squint, you see that this gene is no longer expressed. The cells do not die. They don't have a real problem in terms of their in terms of survival or proliferation. What happens instead of becoming mesoderm, they will become another tissue type, ectoderm. Okay. And the same is happening when you remove the receptor. Okay. So from this kind of expression pattern, and then also the expression pattern of the ligand, which I told you are down here, we kind of infer that directly or indirectly, nodal signals act at a certain range to activate these cells to express these downstream genes. So determine mesoderm and endoderm. So now we take away lefty. So this is the antagonist of the pathway. And what you see is, so we already showed you this, in a wild type you get this kind of expression pattern. Now if you take away the inhibitor, you get a much broader domain of expression. So the antagonist, and we will discuss how this happens, somehow blocks the extent here of mesoderm and endoderm. And again, this is nodal dependent, so if you take away both the signal, the agonist and the antagonist, you don't get any expression anymore.
It's also okay. I mean, what I'm seeing there is that the peak level is also higher in P than in K. So is that true?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to quantify this. This is actually it's not the perfect probe. I mean, it takes some time. So I will show you later that what Matthew is kind of implying is that maybe lefty, if you take away lefty, you get much more signaling here than here. And I think lefty in general serves as a dampener of the response. So we can discuss this. So this could be real, although I would not, it's not quantitative. Yeah. Okay, so just if we, going back or what happens? Okay, so from this, lefty being expressed down here normally, so if you take it away, now the genes are expressed inappropriately up here, kind of implies that lefty somehow, and we will discuss how, blocks the activation of these genes in these distant cells here. So this happens always in 2 or 3 hours. So it's much faster than let's say the DPP imaginal disk response. So you make the signal, and within 2 hours you get a response. And we'll talk about the timing a little bit later. After nodal, I think half an hour or so. We have nodal, and then half an hour later you will induce lefty. Yeah, so it's pretty fast. Yeah, and then and that's true for other downstream genes too. Yeah, so it's very, very quick. No one has really followed the dynamics very carefully though. That's one thing I'll discuss at the end. So just to summarize, so this kind of implies, nodal and lefty are expressed down here. Nodal is expressed first. If you only have nodal, I showed you, you get kind of this, broad induction of these genes. If you now add lefty, you only get a shorter range of induction. So that's just kind of summarizing the result. So the question, how does this happen? So now there's a complication in the fish where you have two nodal signals, both squint and cyclops. And so I told you, when you take both away, you lose expression completely of these downstream genes. But now if you only take away cyclops, and you still have squint in this case, and squint is still down here, what you see is that you actually do not need cyclops, at least at this stage, for this pattern of expression. Basically, this looks like wild type, and you take away lefty, you still get this broad induction of downstream genes. So if you take away, so this implies that squint alone is sufficient for this kind of pattern here. You don't need the other nodal signal. If you take away squint now, where you still have cyclops, what you find is that you only get this very narrow band, basically overlapping with the cyclop expression, and this also happens if you take away lefty. So basically, what these cyclops is down here. So what this suggests is that cyclops only acts at a short range, squint acts at longer range, and the main function of lefty seems to be to block the activity or the squint-dependent activation of genes up here. Okay, because if you take away squint, you don't really, lefty doesn't matter if you have lefty or if you don't have lefty. Okay. So just to summarize this, so if you just have cyclops in the system, we get kind of a narrow induction. If you add squint, we have a broad induction. If you add lefty, we get kind of intermediate range of induction. So what I imply, of course, here are mechanisms, and these mechanisms we have to test. So the mechanism I imply here is, of course, that squint acts at a long range. So squint made down here activates signaling in distant cells. The other thing I imply is that cyclops is acting only at a short range. And then the third thing I imply here is that lefty acts at a long range. But you could also imagine, of course, that squint activates another factor, and then this other factor mediates this effect. and this has always been a problem in the morphogen field, and I think in many instances it still is. You never really know if this signal does the job up here, or if you induce another signal in a relay that does the job. Similarly, you know, I proposed that lefty acts at a long range to inhibit signaling here. But of course, you can imagine another mechanism where lefty blocks the expression of squint, and then you have less squint, and you know, that's how you get this restricted expression then. So there are many levels where how these factors could regulate this field. And you know, this goes also back to what Matthew already told you. You know, where does Argos act? You know, there are cases where Argos is thought to act, you know, far away. Then we saw when you get these, you know, little appendages that Argos would only act very, very locally. So one has to try to distinguish between those different mechanisms. So I show you some. So I show you actually a lot of data, because I think it's important that, you know, that it's not only conceptual, but that you actually see how the data looks like, because it's often much more noisy than, you know, our beautiful beautiful models. Okay, so most of this work has been done by Yu Chen, a postdoc in the lab. And so what we do, the system we use, we kind of recapitulate what we see here at the margin in this territory up here. And so in the ideal world, we would try to visualize, of course, each of those signals. And so far, we have not been able to do that. And you saw from Aurelio, I mean, with DPP, you can do this, DPP GFP fusions, you can see, you know, the distribution of DPP. And we have also talked about the caveats, because you don't really know what you see. You see these vesicles, but is this really the active DPP? Or, you know, what you really would like to see is the ligand bound to the receptor. And at the moment, people have not developed tools to really be able to do that. So
where is the local expressed normally in the end?
Right down here.
Yeah. You haven't explained why it's like that.
That's a completely different story. Okay. Yeah. There's some alternative determinants. Yeah. So
it's still impossible to do FRET on, there's not a high enough concentration of receptor ligand?
No one has, people are trying, but there's not, in a multicellular organism, I don't think there's a single good example where people have used it successfully. Definitely not extracellular. There's one example in the cell, but not outside the cell. Yeah. So that's, and we can talk about these problems at the end, but I think they already came out, particularly in Norbert's talk. I think it became obvious where the kind of limitations are at the moment. So, but basically what we can do, of course, and that's what Aurelio did and Norbert did, you of course look at the readout of the system. So you look at the induction of downstream genes as a kind of a reporter of where the signal is activated, signaling pathway is activated. So what we do, we inject RNA with a lineage tracer, which tells us where we inject. It would be kind of a fluorescent color here. And then we wait 2 or 3 hours. And then we can also, these brown cells now were the cells that have been injected. Okay, so here we inject just the control RNA, but now if you inject squint, the nodal, the RNA for the nodal signal, you see that you can now induce this kind of halo around the squint clone. Okay, and so this is very similar to what you see at the margin. At the margin, I showed you, you know, you would have squint down here, and then you induce no-tail further away. So this is very similar, you know, 6 to 8 cells or so. From the source, you induce no-tail. So if you do the same experiment with Cyclops, again, similar as what you see at the margin, you only see induction of this gene at a very short range. And this is actually not a problem of activity of this protein, because at the moment, the difference between Cyclops and squint seems to be only in its range, because we know that Cyclops at this concentration can activate other genes. It can basically activate every gene that squint can activate. So it's as potent as an activator or binding to the receptor and activating it as squint is. But the major difference is that Cyclops only acts locally and squint acts further away. And so this is, I think, maybe another theme why it's actually great to have many different signals, because it allows you to modulate the response and basically the range where you get the response to a particular signal. I don't know if this has been done in the case of the EGFs, but I think this is a very clear case where, depending on which signal you use, although they seem to be identical in terms of what receptors they activate and what downstream genes, you know, they induce, the difference really is that they might have different ranges. And so for example, Cyclops is used later in neural development, And it's used in a context where you actually only want to induce a single row of cells to change their fate. So it actually would make sense that that's where you employ Cyclops, but not Squint, because Cyclops is short range. So this just adds, I think, an additional level of regulation. We do not know the molecular basis for this difference in range. That's still unclear. Yeah.
Those cells in vivo receive the Squint signal. Do they get different state of differentiation than the other one?
Yeah, they will. I will come back to that. So first part, I will just talk about the range, and then we'll briefly mention that you actually have kind of a gradient where cells close to the source will form, for example, endoderm or pre-caudal plate. Other cells will form where cells have a different fate. But at the moment, I just want to focus on the range. Yeah. Okay. So this is kind of showing what we have at the margin. So you know, Squint made here can activate this gene. That's right. And I'll show that. So this is, of course, very, very similar conceptually to what has been done, you know, extensively by John Gurdon using activin or activin beads. The problem with activin is that at the moment the evidence is not very strong that it's actually used in vivo as a mesoderm inducer. So, but we can discuss this at the end. So basically, this is very similar to what I showed you at the margin. Cyclops is short range. And Squint acts at a long range. It depends on the levels, but you know, at least 10 cells.
Not 100.
They are not actually only to the tip of the embryo. It's only 50 cells.
Okay,
yeah, but it can. If you take away lefty, it goes easily. You know, 20 to 30 cells. So it's pretty far. But we actually look how this happens. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, you know, is this really direct? So Squint made here activates gene induction over here, or activates the signaling pathway here, or does Squint activate, I already mentioned this, activate a relay signal that does the job? So it kicks, you know, in Matthew's word, it kicks someone else. And, you know, then the signal, this other signal does the job. Or, you know, another mechanism, of course, is Squint activates, kind of a, you know, domino effect. You know, you kick your neighbor and then kicks your next neighbor and so on, until you have this induction up here. And so this is actually not so easy to distinguish. In most developmental contexts, this actually has not been critically tested if the signal you think does the job really does the job you think it does, or if it does of someone else mediates its effect. And so one experiment I show you to test this is making use of this of these coreceptor mutants. So now we take an embryo that doesn't have the coreceptor, and so if I make Squint in this embryo, nothing happens. The embryo is completely resistant to the activity of this signal. So that's depicted here. Now what we do, we provide the signal and the coreceptor in the same cell here. So now this cell should respond to the signal, and if there is a relay signal, like FGF, for example, the signal should be activated here, travel out here, and induce, you know, downstream genes out here. But that's actually what we do not see this. We only see response in this embryo only where you have both Squint and the coreceptor. So this argues against the relay. So let me just show you the data. So here you see these are individual cells that express this downstream gene. And you see now, then we detect where do we inject, where's the lineage tracer, and what we see that each of these cells also expresses the lineage tracer. You don't see a single blue spot here that expresses the gene that does not express the receptor. So this argues against some forms of the relay, but not every form of the relay. So now we can do the other experiment, a more direct test. Again, we take an embryo that's completely unresponsive to the signal. We make the signal here. And now we put responding cells, the only cells that have the receptor here, at a distance. And so the only way Squint could activate here is by Squint being activating genes at a distance, because it cannot activate a relay in this scenario. So this is, I think, the kind of most direct test, if a signal directly can act at a distance. So in this experiment, we make Squint in non-responding cells. It's surrounded by non-responding cells, and then in the distance we have responding cells. And indeed, as I show in a second, these cells can now respond to Squint-made made at a distance. So just to show the data. So again, we make the squint here. Okay, this is an embryo that does not respond to squint. Then we put cells here that can respond to squint or could respond to squint at a distance. And we follow these cells too to exclude one of Aurelio's models, you know, where cells actually, instead of the morphogen moving away to the cell, you know, the cell could move to the morphogen. So in this case, you see that the responding cells here stay away from the signaling cell. And what you see is that these cells now do induce the downstream gene. So and in this case, we cannot induce a relay. So squint mate here can activate genes here at a distance. So these kind of experiments, you know, provide evidence that squint really directly acts at a distance to induce gene expression. Please note that this experiment is in the background of a receptor dead, or in a context where you cannot activate the receptor, which has some implications for the models that we talked about. So how is long distance effect achieved? I think Aurelia and Norbert already addressed this. So the first possibility, of course, was the movement of cells that express the signal. So you move cells that express the signal towards the responding cells, and then you just, you know, touch each other and transmit and activate the pathway. And this doesn't happen here because I showed you, you can keep the source and the responding cells separate and they never come close to each other. And Aurelio for DPP also provided evidence for that. The second model is movement through extracellular space. So you make the signal, and then the signal, you know, goes between the cells, goes out here, and then activates downstream response here. And I still think, I don't think there's any evidence really against this mechanism in any system. So I still think this is the most likely model, or, you know, most likely way of how a signal is transmitted. The second an additional model is, of course, movement through cells. So the transcytosis model that we already heard about. So you move through the cells, you're taken up by cell, release, taken up, and so on, until you reach, you know, your final destination here and activate this pathway. And so there are, so the strictest form of the transcytosis model says that you have to bind and activate the receptor to be transported across the field. That's the very strict form of the transcytosis model. And if this were the case in our system, we could not have done the last experiment I showed you, because I told you we can make the signal in non-responding cell, and, you know, it can travel or move through non-responding cells and then activate a signaling here at a distance. So I think experiments like this do not bode well for the... Beg your pardon?
At least that receptor.
That's correct. So it could still be that you have another receptor that mediates transport. You can never, of course, you can never exclude that. But at the moment, there's no evidence for this. And I think the DPP case, the argument, I mean, the Gonzalez-Gaetan argument is that you have to activate thick vein to get this. Because thick vein mutant clones, you can't travel through thick vein mutant clones.
Because there is no receptor right here. You do have a receptor. You don't have a co-receptor.
That's right, but you cannot bind to the... okay, so in terms of biochemistry, you cannot bind to the receptor. Yeah. And actually, yeah. That's right. And so we don't have mutants. We have mutants, but you have to remove both the maternal and zygotic receptor. So eventually we'll be able to do this. And, you know, the nice thing about the fish system, I mean, you can just put drugs on them and block transcytosis because it's very accessible. Everything happens very fast, so we're doing stuff like that now. The third model that you heard about is the cellular extension model, or cytonemes of Filopodia, where you basically have the source here, and, you know, a responding cell will be here, sends out these long filopodia, and, you know, hits this cell, gets the signal, and then activates back here. There's one argument, I think, against, again, the strictest form of the model, but you can always argue way out, is, of course, that if this is the case, and every evidence we have so far is that cyclops, which acts short-range, activates the same pathway as squint does. So we basically have a tethered nodal here in the case of cyclops, but it cannot activate, you know, cells here signaling at in distant cells. Of course, you can say, well, there might be something else different between cyclops and squint, and But I think everything so far points to this kind of movement. Yeah. Yeah.
Could you check that by, let's say, putting some degradation signal on the protein and some N-terminal, you know, some dead box or something like that? Do you expect the degradation to see that it actually changes?
Yeah. So we have some evidence for that kind of model. We had a collaboration with Daniel Constant in Lausanne, and he's expressing these proteins in tissue culture and can measure their stability. And we actually find that there, and then we test them in vivo for the range, and there's indeed, there seems to be a correlation between stability and range. So I think that's a good proposition. But in vivo, no one has looked at the dynamics of the decay. So that's the main problem or lack of data that we have. But I think in this system, we will be able to address it. But I think dead box wouldn't work because that acts in the cell, but you can make protease sensitive sites outside the cell. Yeah, Richard? That's correct. Yeah, these experiments are technically very hard. I think that might be a case, especially after what I tell you for Lefty. Yeah, I think it's very well possible. Yeah. But I think all these experiments we will kind of do when we have a nice, in vivo labeling of the receptor. Then you can overexpress the receptors or no receptor, and then you can relook at the distribution. So I think that will be the crucial thing. You can do it embryologically, but that's very, technically challenging. Yeah?
Have you computed a diffusion constant that would explain how the signal goes in half an hour?
Have not done it. So it can move about 100 micrometers in an hour. So it's pretty fast. So, yeah, some of you guys should compute it. Yeah. And at the same time, you would of course like to know, how quickly does it get, degraded, which is true for Bicoid too. I think again, Bicoid, it's made, moves away. I don't, do we really know how fast it moves away? Maybe we don't know how fast it moves away. So maybe, in a year or two, we might know much more about dynamics of the system. Okay, so now let's talk about Lefty. So how does Lefty do this? So I told you that if you add Lefty to the system, you only get a smaller field of cells activating the signaling pathway. So again, now I have to introduce you to some of the cross-regulation here. So squint activates Lefty, so the agonist activates the antagonist. This one here, Cyclops, also activates Lefty. So it's very similar to what you heard about Argos. It's a feedback inhibitor. We also know that squint induces its own production, so it induces squint protein, induces squint RNA transcription, and Lefty can block this too. Okay, so now you have two components here in this kind of model. You have kind of a long-range inhibition model where Lefty moves away and then somehow blocks the activity of squint in distant cells. The other model is, of course, that here Lefty would block the production of squint. And both these scenarios could explain, the result I showed you, because let's say we take away the long-range inhibition, so now squint could be active here. We don't even have to change the distribution of squint. We could just change the response to squint by taking away Lefty, and now you activate gene expression back here. The other possibility, of course, is the autoregulation. So if you take away this kind of loop, now squint can kind of autoregulate or produce itself out of control. You make more squint, and now squint can also act here. So in this case, you would change the distribution of squint.
Why does it stop?
I don't know. Well, not necessarily, because you have also, you have some other developmental timing. So eventually cells might not be responsive anymore because they don't express, transcription factor it's the same hand-waving argument that Matthew made. We actually do not know what competence what competence means. We don't know what that means, being responsive or not responsive, and how does the embryo measure time?
We don't know what that is. I thought it was just combinations of transcription.
Yeah, but I mean.
Oh, what they
but,
are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What you say? There is a pre pattern here.
There is a. There's definitely a pre pattern. Yeah. So to get these guys, of course, you need some pre pattern. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Everything happens down here. There's no evidence that something's up here. So it could, you know, so, but eventually, you know, the embryo keeps on developing. So maybe there's a certain time when you cannot respond to squint anymore. I mean, that's clearly the case. And I don't know if it's just transcription. I mean, you know, of course you can say it's transcription factor, but it could also be chromatin. You know, we don't really know what that means. You know? Yeah, but as you will see in a second, the squint can actually induce its transcription here. So let's actually look at the data. So how do we just, you know, so as I said, you know, you just make more squint and then you can activate gene expression up here. So how can we distinguish between those models? So in the autoregulation model, what you would predict, if I take away lefty, I should see more squint. And that's actually what you see. So here you look at just at the onset of gastrulation. So, you know, 2 or 3 hours after squint gets expressed, you see that in a wild-type embryo, we can't detect squint RNA anymore. But now in this guy here, where you take away the antagonist, you see persistent and broad expression of squint. And that, you know, correlates actually with this broadened expression of no-tail. So clearly, blocking squint production plays a role. That's one way of how lefty acts. But you notice early on, at the earliest time point here, we cannot really, although this is not quantitative, we cannot really distinguish between squint expression here in the wild type or without the antagonist. Although at this stage already, you see that this downstream gene here is already more broadly expressed than in a wild type. So from this kind of experiment, we think, well, maybe left isn't just blocking autoregulation. So how do we test this more directly? This is shown here. So here what we do, we again make use of these mutants. So we take now an embryo that doesn't have any endogenous squint. Okay, so, and then we provide squint externally. And now this external squint will not be able to autoregulate or activate the endogenous squint because it's not there. Okay, so if lefty only does block squint autoregulation, shouldn't matter if you have lefty or if you don't have lefty because you have already blocked autoregulation. So the embryo shouldn't care, and you should just get induction such as this. However, if lefty, for example, acts as a long-range inhibitor, you should now see a broadening of induction of downstream genes if you take away lefty. And that's actually what you see. So here, we actually remove both nodal signals in this case. Then we make squint here by RNA injection, and you see this kind of induction here. And now you take away lefty, you see it's much, much broader. Okay. So this argues against, you know, simple role, although lefty does block squint autoregulation, that's not sufficient to explain this result. And so of course the tempting model is that lefty blocks acts as a long-range inhibitor. And the way to test this is we now make lefty up here, far away from where it normally is, and ask, can the lefty up here, you know, travel down here and block nodal signaling in these distant cells? And you know, I wouldn't show you if it didn't. So this is the wild-type control here. You see the downstream gene, and now we express lefty far away. You know, this is now 50 cells. And what we see is that you do not get this induction down here. So from this we can say that lefty can act at a long range, although we have of course not shown that it actually does act at a long range when it's expressed down here. But I think this is very, very suggestive. So from this kind of, you know, these kind of experiments, we conclude that squint, you know, we conclude that there's this kind of, you know, interaction of these different factors. So you have a short-range signal, you have a long-range signal, you have a long-range inhibitor, but then you also have these cross-regulatory interactions down here where you block the production of the signal, you induce the inhibitor. So you can, you know, at least that's what some physics friends tell me, you can, you know, build a pretty complex, you know, little machine to control the extent of this mesoderm progenitors just by changing some of the interactions here. So for example, you make a little bit more lefty, you will reduce this field. Or you make a little bit more squint, you can induce this. You know, at the same time, you of course. So then it also depends how much left you induce. So I think one could maybe play around a little bit with this and see if one, what kind of patterns one could generate. Yeah.
Have you ever showed us the expression pattern of left V?
It's down here. I mentioned it. It's exactly down here. It's exactly where squint and cyclops are.
It's a very high threshold.
That's right. That's correct. Yeah. 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 And that's, and again, that's similar to Argos. You know, Argos is only expressed where you have the highest levels of Gorton or Spitz. Yeah. Okay. So, but yeah. Okay. So now. So this kind of interaction. So I have to flash up this slide because it's you know, this Physics Institute. So Alan Turing, of course, although you know, Lewis said there are no Turing models and or Turing waves or whatever you might call them in the embryo, there are subsets of these interactions that are part of the reaction diffusion model that Turing proposed. Although, to be fair, the way Turing proposes that you have, as you know. First, you have kind of equal distribution of an activator and an inhibitor. Then you introduce a slight disturbance, and then you can generate pattern. Here, and that's, I think, in general in biology, you always have a pre-pattern. And so, you know, so what Turing proposed, and Geer and Meinhardt kind of translated into biology, is of course that you have an activator, you know, that can act at a certain range, although it doesn't really necessarily have to act at a long range, but also has an autocatalytic component. It activates an inhibitor, and the inhibitor blocks autocatalysis and also kind of blocks the spread of this activating signal. So that's one form of this. You guys probably know more about this than I do, but this is one form of this reaction diffusion models. And of course, you know, so you have this autoregulatory component, you have this long-range inhibition component, and of course, this is exactly what I showed you with Squint and Lefty. Although I must say, this is probably the most kind of simple or, you know, trivial version of a Turing model. Yeah.
Well, I think it's exactly the Turing model that LiDAR and Geer developed. But the diffusion concept I got from the numbers you said is 6 times 10 to the minus 7 centimeters per year second. Or, you know, a protein diffusing in water. How do you slow down the squint? Because an important part of that model is that
that's right. So we have not. So that's again where we have to visualize this. But you're right. One prediction is that Lefty moves faster than Squint. Otherwise, you know, how could it act out here? And the molecular biology suggests actually that Lefty might be a monomer. So that might also make it easier to diffuse. It could, that's right, or more active, or more active. That's right. So you do not, so we talk about the active, so Lefty has to be more active out here than Squint. So there are many ways to do this. You just make more left, you have more Lefty out here, or a little bit of Lefty is very potent in blocking the response to Squint.
I don't think that's right. I mean, I don't do this kind of model myself, but maybe Lewis, do you remember? I think if you said these are equal, you just don't get the instability. Regardless of the amounts of stuff.
It all depends on the parameters you choose. Also, I think, I mean, I'm very impressed with all the lambda stuff, and also the evidence now that the extracellular matrix can have a very important effect.
Right. Right. Say that loud.
Oh, so
you said
you have a source of stuff, so you don't need
the Turing
instability.
No,
right. So it doesn't have to be that.
Anymore.
But this mechanism, if the source weren't nailed down,
yep.
Would
Yeah, that's what we see. I mean, that's what we're trying now. But you don't see stripes and spots. So far, we have not generated stripes and spots using this kind of system.
But you could get the RNA from these factors in the way you build the cells.
Yeah. That's exactly what we're trying to do now. You know, play around, and that's what we do with a guide loosened, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now, so what I so far talked about is just simply the range of these signals, Now, you know, as Claude already alluded to, of course, there's already patterning here. So, for example, cells that are very close to the source or overlapping the source will form one tissue type, such as endoderm or head mesoderm, and cells that are a little further away will form mainly mesoderm or on this side here, a tissue called notochord, so more posterior mesoderm. It doesn't really matter what the tissue is, but we know that there are actually different genes that are expressed close to the source and then some that are expressed further from the source. That has been known for many years. And actually, what you can do genetically, I already told you, so there would be, for example, on one side of the embryo, there would be these three cell types, progenitors for pre-caudal plate, it's called, progenitors for notochord, and progenitor for neural tissue. I told you already, if you take away nodal signaling completely, all this will become neural. Now, if you make mutants where you block nodal signaling a little bit, what you get is that this tissue type here is now transformed into this tissue type. And so, of course, it's tempting to speculate that you have kind of a gradient of a lot of nodal signal here, less here, and nothing here. And now, if you make a little bit less, you know, you have very little here, and now you transform this into another tissue type. You can also see this, for example, here with different downstream genes. So here you look at this one gene I already told you about, which is expressed, you know, about 10 cells from the margin. Let's see if this works. You take away left, it gets much broader. So now here, this is another gene called Goosequid, which only responds to high levels of nodal signaling. So you only see it, you know, in three or so cells or four cells at the margin. Again, it also responds the same way to lefty. If you take away lefty, you also broaden this. So it's not like lefty is really changing the response. Lefty seems to, in general, dampen the response to the nodal signal. So you could, I mean, in the most simple case, you would say the response is like this. If you only have squint, if you add lefty, you know, you push it down a little bit. So we don't see kind of unequal. You know, there are some models, for example, that say, let's say, we will probably hear this about this tomorrow. There's another inhibitor, for example, that's required to transport the agonist, you know, to some far away. So then you would see a different response of high response and low response genes depending on the antagonist. So in this case, it seems to be relatively simple that you just dampen the response. Yep.
If you play with your injection experiment,
yep.
You inject different levels.
Yep.
How much can you control the range of?
Yeah, I'll show this in a second. Just let me just point out one more thing. So if you take away squint, for example, you still activate no-tail here, as we already showed, but now you don't activate Goosequid anymore. So that's one way where you can lower the signaling. So this is the experiment you just mentioned. So I already showed you this. If you now express squint here, you can get this nice halo of no tail. If you inject less tenfold less RNA, you just get this more, you know, restricted circle here. And in this case, you don't induce Goosequid anymore, but in this case, you still do. So there seems to be, you know, and of course, these kind of experiments have been done by Gurdon with activin beads. You put an activin bead here, and you see a very similar kind of response depending how much you need. And I can inject, you know, much more here and then make it much even broader. Yeah. And so that's kind of, the, you know, where we are going now, also depending on what you guys tell me later. But, you know, of course, you would like to know, you know, can we learn something from how much we inject here, how quickly this spreads, how fast it spreads, how far it spreads.
Yeah. Cyclophin immunistochastic effect
on development.
Yeah, for example.
Yeah, so if you do this with cyclops, you would see the same response in terms of Goosequid and squint. So it's not, but cyclops would only induce short range.
But qualitatively, exact same thing.
Qualitatively, we cannot distinguish between what they do in terms of receptor or downstream gene activation.
So it's totally redundant.
Let's talk about this. Yeah, is it totally redundant? Yeah, I'll come to that at the end. That's an extra complication. So from this, you know, Eric Davidson isn't here, so I guess I can use the morphogen word. So you know, so now I think with squint we can demonstrate that it can act at a long range directly and also in a concentration dependent manner. Okay, so this now allows you, of course, you know, more further patterning, instead of just simply regulating the extent of this field here, you can also say, okay, now these guys here see more signal, so I make a different cell type here. And again, you can play now with this. So, you know, you make different levels of squint, you can expand the field. And I showed you, if you take away, if you make less squint, for example, or less nodal signaling, you lose this cell fate down here and transform it to another cell fate. Yep.
So, to play with it even more, how would you put this mechanism to work in a big fish?
Yeah, very interesting question. Very interesting question. And there are. So, actually, there it goes back to Eric's, you know, big hood experiment. And people have not looked at that. So, but actually, there are not that many big fish eggs. I mean, they're maybe twice as big, but you, I don't know of an example where you get an egg like this where that's tenfold the size. So twice as big, you could handle. I mean, maybe it's enough to make just mesoderm down here, and then you just have more ectoderm. But we would have to look into that.
Do you know if a larger fish develops slower? Because if you made it twice as big, you take
about 4 times. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure.
But our big fish have bigger.
Bigger eggs. Yeah. No, so the problem is if you increase this field, you know, so what Gary's saying, you know, if this is the same mechanism and it's only 10 cells or 15 cells, you know, then, but the other 100 cells would all become ectoderm. So we should look into a bunch of big fish. Yeah.
Again, you can control it by degradation.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, how it diffuses, how it's bound to the extracellular matrix. So there are ways to control it. But it would actually be interesting, is it controlled? I mean, there are big vertebrates, I mean, like chick is a really big vertebrate, but they also use nodal signaling, although there it's not really clear at what range it acts there. And so it hasn't been done carefully. So it might actually be more interesting to go to other vertebrates and see what happens in those. Mouse is really small. Mouse would be kind of here, I guess. And if you take the mouse nodal and put it into the fish, it seems to be kind of medium range. So I don't know if that's meaningful for the mouse, but there might be a lot of regulation at this level. I think that's why squint versus cyclops is kind of an interesting case. And I come back to that in a second. Okay, so we can generate complex patterns. So the way I portrayed it, and I think that's a little bit the way we all portrayed the morphogen gradient so far, is that more of kind of a spatial thing. So everything we kind of showed you was frozen at a particular, you know, time, and then we show you, okay, we have this gradient, and depending on, you know, how much you have, you get a different response. But of course, what really happens is that there's you know, timing, you know, so nodal comes on first in these cells down here, then you activate lefty. So, you know, you not only have space, but you also have time. And then, maybe most importantly, that's, I think, a very complicating factor, is cell movement. So, all the systems you heard about, like the imaginal disk, for example, or the early Drosophila embryo, you don't really have to worry too much about cells mixing. But that's actually a big problem, I mean, particularly in vertebrates. And so I think one question will be, if you have a lot of cell movement, actually, is it clever to use those long-range signals? And maybe it's not. Maybe one principle could be you only use long-range signal if the tissue is relatively non-mixing. Because otherwise, you know, things would get extremely confused. That hasn't really been tested yet, but I think I would make this prediction. So let's talk about time. So I told you, you know, so this thing comes, so squint is expressed, you know, 2 hours before this. And so what happens is, of course, that these cells here see squint before the neighboring cells see it. And so, you know, it can spread probably within an hour or so, or 2 hours up here, probably faster, maybe in an hour or so. But still, you know, these guys see it a little earlier than these guys. So the question is, does this play a role? And that's, we don't actually understand this at all, I think. But there's some evidence for that. So for example, what we can do, we can take the embryo and block nodal signaling at different time. So we can take the antagonist and add it back at different times, or we can take a receptor mutant and add the receptor back at different times. So we can generate different lengths of where the pathway can be activated. And what we find is, although I showed you this slide before where I said, okay, I just dampened nodal signaling, actually you see this very same result. So if you have normal nodal signaling, which one would call, might want to call sustained nodal signaling, you get this pattern. Now if I keep the block it early or late, it doesn't really matter when I block it, but I limit the window of nodal signaling, I will get this kind of response. So, and that's something I think we don't really know how to deal with, I think. And so if you look at molecularly, this would kind of mean this from a review from Gurdon. This would mean, so for 1 hour of let's say nodal, being exposed to nodal, you bind some receptors. After 2 hours, you bind more receptors. And there actually have been experiments where you can give, let's say, a certain amount of activin to a cell for 20 minutes. You get one response. Now you wash it away. And then you do an experiment where you take half the amount, but for twice the time, and you can induce the same response. So timing really plays a very important role. And you know, this will be depicted here. So after 2 hours, you know, these guys now bind a lot, but the cells that are further away might only start seeing the signal, and so they're still in this kind of response. So how we will, I think it will be very difficult for us until we do more like dynamic studies to figure out how timing and spatial information come together. So it's not like you just set up a gradient and then you read the gradient in space. It really might depend a lot on when do you see the signal. Mm-hmm. And that, yeah?
It depends on potency?
It doesn't, no. Yeah, so it's, yeah, does not depend on protein synthesis, yeah. That's another way to show actually that many of these genes are direct downstream genes. So even in the case of BigQuid, actually, it's not so clear. You know, you make BigQuid early. So I think the first nuclei, I see more BigQuid earlier than nuclei that are further away. I don't know if this plays a role, but I don't think it has really been addressed. So then the third problem we face is movement. And so here I leave you with a conundrum. So I told you, if we take away squint, you know, you only get this little bit here of presumptive mesoderm. Okay, so you would predict that this fish, you know, should be pretty poor in terms of making mesoderm, and probably should lack most endoderm. And that's actually not the case. So the amazing thing I think is that this is a squint mutant. You get variable phenotypes, but you can get actually some squint fish that recover and look, you know, pretty good. Sometimes you even get a few escapers that you can grow to adulthood.
And how variable is the mesoderm induction, if you showed that in the previous picture?
That is very stable. So this, what I just showed you, that's true for all squint embryos. Okay. Yeah. So the recovery, we followed this, I don't show you the data, but we followed this recovery a little bit. So over time, you get some of these mesodermal marker genes back. And there's not a delay in development. It really, suddenly, you start generating more mesoderm. And the question, and this is, of course, cyclops dependent, because in a cyclops mutant, in a cyclops squint double mutant, you don't see this. So somehow, cyclops is able, over time, to compensate for the loss of squint. Yeah?
Can we come back to the staining pattern?
Yeah.
The squint mutant? Uh-oh. I mean, your probe shows a very narrow active band, but how do you know your probe threshold?
That's correct, but it shows me that there's a clear difference between, you know, the wild type situation and the situation here. So although this pattern is very narrow, these cells here, I'll show you actually in a second, these cells are actually able, some of them are able to form mesoderm. So this is a fate map, so we label cells and ask what do they give rise to. So this is again these kind of tears here at the margin, and if you do this, you find this is mesoderm. So these are all the cells that will become mesoderm, and it's basically, you know, the data point is not as good. This was done with collaboration with Rachel Varga's lab. You find that the territory is basically the same. So the same cells that did not express this downstream gene can form mesoderm, will contribute to mesoderm later. You also see, however, that some cells here form neural and you never see neural down here in a normal embryo. So now some cells here, in the absence of squint, will become neural, but other cells can later contribute to mesoderm. And as I said, this is cyclops dependent. So how could we explain it? So one way to explain this is, if you look at the expression of cyclops, actually it persists at the margin through gastrulation. That's very strong expression on the dorsal side, but you see it here at the margin. And so one model one could come up with, although it will take us some time to test it, is of course that what happens is that, let's say you have cyclops here and here, and so now the model that I dismissed for squint could actually be that you might have a cell that's initially here, has not received squint, so it's not on the way to become mesoderm, but as the embryo rearranges, the cell might come here under the influence of cyclops just by moving to the source, or being carried passively to the source, gets the signal here, and then makes mesoderm. So that's what I meant with, you know, that we should not forget about the possibility of, you know, instead of the signal being carried to the cell might be carried to the signal. And we don't know if this is the case here, but I think there's, for example, in wingless, in the Drosophila embryo, there's a strong case for wingless from Jean-Paul Vincent's lab, where he actually shows that some cells do go to the wingless expressing cells, get the signal, and then move away again. And I think that's again something, you know, we cannot really study if we look just at dorsal gradients or picoid gradients.
Leptin doesn't get induced or something
in these circumstances. Weakly, but it's there. There's some lefty there. Less. Yeah.
There's no compensation of transcription of by cyclops.
We don't see more cyclops, but we don't see more. Yeah. So what Claude is absolutely right to point out is that, you know, so you don't have squint, so you have less lefty, and so maybe now you're able to respond better to cyclops. But cyclops is still going to be short range, so you still have to kind of explain how a cell from up here will form mesoderm later. Yeah. But what you know, alternatively, we don't know if cyclops induces a relay. We have not tested if cyclops can induce a relay. So maybe in this instance, cyclops induces FGF, then FGF acts at a certain range. So, but I just want to kind of, you know, end by saying, okay, these spatial gradients are really nice, but I think what we really have to grapple with is more of the timing and the movement that contributes to the interpretation. Okay, so in summary, squint is long range, has concentration-dependent activity. Lefty can block both squint production and also can act as a long-range inhibitor. Cyclops is short-range and can compensate for loss of squint after some time, not early on. And then duration of signaling might or can modulate the response of cells to the signal. And so I think all this points to the work we have to do now is to really figure out, maybe also to be able to model it in a more quantitative fashion, you know, what controls the production of these signals. So, for example, also in the TGF-betas, you also have proteases that cleave them, so that might also be a level of regulation. How do they move? Diffusion constants. How are they perceived? So how do they bind to the receptors? So, for example, John Gurdon has shown that you only need 100 receptors to be activated, or actually to be bound per cell, to induce one of those genes. So 100 receptors bound per cell are enough to elicit a downstream response. So that's very low levels we're talking about here. And then how is it transmitted? Is there an amplification mechanism, as Matthew implied, might not be very important in the case of morphogen gradients, although there is an amplification. I mean, these are enzymes. So you activate serine threonine kinases. There are enzymes that can turn over and, you know, phosphorylate several SMAD molecules. So there's clearly some kind of amplification. And then finally, you know, how do you interpret the signal, which still not really understood. So I think they are bigger than dorsal. Probably dorsal is the best studied case to figure that out. So I just, again, would like to say Eugene did most of this work. And then all the work was based on work from previous people in the lab, Jiajia Zhang and Kira Gritzman, and also our collaborator, Bill Talbot. Thank you.
Very nice.